This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the author of The Misquotable C.S. Lewis. What follows is the second and final part of the panel discussion from the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium at Taylor University. I also plan to share highlights from the various keynote presentations in the near future. For this podcast, you'll hear the rest of the answers to the questions posed by Joe Rickey, the conference coordinator and host for the panel discussion, as well as there will be questions from the audience. The theme for the 2018 colloquium was the Faithful Imagination. And the guests were Stephen Prickett, Crystal Downing, Joe Christopher, Crystal Hurd, and Charlie Starr. I'll provide brief bios on those individuals at the end of this episode. Also, I'll break in to tell you the questions from the audience because they were not mic'd. If you heard part one of this podcast, then you know that I left you hanging with an answer from Charlie Starr. But before we get into that, let me mention that there will be a bonus at the end of this podcast. I'll tell you about that at the close of the panel discussion portion. But to start things off, I'll go back and let you hear Joe Rickey's question and then Charlie's complete answer.
Tell me what you've read recently that, and now it's not one of these authors. Just you're sharing with us because we like you and we want to learn, and if we had time, we'd all be sharing this way. And I hope we will maybe later today. People just talk with each other. But what are you reading? What have you read that's impressed you the way the book Stephen just talked about a moment ago?
The Master and His Emissary.
What was it again?
The Master and His Emissary.
The Master and His Emissary.
I've been reading Jane Austen, and that's been very nice. But
that's perfectly very, very fine, Crystal. Crystal Hurd.
Let me name a book that I've read now probably a decade ago, which is 100 pages, and it seems incredibly simple, and you might even accuse it of being simplistic. But while I was reading it, I was shaking with excitement and a little bit of anger because he had written the book that I intended to write, and it's a little book by John Eldridge called Epic: The Story God Is Telling. And he tells us what the monomyth is, what the one story is, the story that God is telling. And he uses film illustrations to point out that we keep telling this story, too, because we can't help ourselves. As Lewis said in Perelandra, there's a society of mind, a web of interconnected minds. And that's how the higher myth of God comes down even among the pagans because of that influence. Well, then Eldridge proves the point by showing us movies that show what the great four acts of the story are. And then then in just 1 minute, I'm going to name three movies that if you haven't seen, you need to see them. They may be peculiar, but one, if you are a lover of myth and fairy tale, you need to see the M. Night Shyamalan movie, Lady in the Water. If you are a lover of film that has rich tapestry of meaning interwoven in and out and reads very much like a novel, but it has all the benefits and joys of film, then a movie that came out in the 90s called The Spitfire Grill. And if you are tired of, I'll put it in quotation marks, Christian movies, then you've got to see the Christian film that almost no Christian has seen, which came out about 6 or 7 years ago, called Henry Poole Is Here.
Since nobody asked me, and if you want to see the best movie made in the last 10 years, you'll see the Polish film, Ida, or you might read it Ida, I-D-A, Ida, about a young woman who is just about ready to enter the convent and finds out that she's actually Jewish, and her family was massacred in the Holocaust, and she was left at the convent door to be saved. It is the most beautiful film, maybe one of the most beautiful films you will ever see. And who has not answered this question? Crystal, have you? Crystal Hurd, you have not. Go ahead.
Well, I've been reading a lot of Southern Lit lately. Yeah. So Faulkner's As I Lay Dying is...
Lee Smith? Have you read Lee Smith?
Yes. Yeah, she's from Grundy, which is about 45 minutes from where I'm
I
from.
Know.
Yeah,
you
we have Bristol. Some mutual friends. That's as cool as I get. I just started Wise Blood by Frank O'Connor. There's two novels. You know, The Violent Bear It Away is in one of her novels. I mean,
The Violent Bear It Away?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Wise Blood were her two novels. And I don't know if you guys are book award snobbies people like I am, but I just read Sing Unburied Sing by Jesmyn Ward, which won the National Book Award. Sing, Unburied, Sing. Yeah, and it just won the National Book Award. It's not for the faint of heart, but it's some of the most beautiful writing, I think, to come out right now.
You have to have Facebook friends like Crystal because she posts a picture of every book she buys. Every time she buys a book, it says a picture of it posted.
HarperCollins cuts me a check.
All right.
I'm kidding. Yeah, I'm poor.
What's happening in our world in terms of Inkling studies, in terms of, you know, I know one thing we could say is the Marion Wade Center has new co-directors, and that's an exciting. Let's hear it for Crystal and David. So that's one thing that's one wonderful thing that's happening in our world, that world that we love and we're scholars and or fans of, that sort of thing. But what else is happening? What do you see happening out there? What's exciting? And what do the rest of us need to know about? And Stephen, why don't we start with you?
Yes, I've been going to Romania for about the past 5 or 6 years now, almost on a yearly basis, to talk mostly about C.S. Lewis. There is a huge enthusiasm for C.S. Lewis in Romania. I'm told now that 25 of his books have already been translated into Romanian, and I had the privilege a couple of years ago of a long coach journey sitting next to the woman who had translated the Narnia stories. And she told me the most remarkable story about this. She was walking home, this was during the Ceausescu years, and she was walking home on a winter's evening, and the snow was brown around her. And there was a brownout on the lights because the electricity supply was not adequate. And she saw this shining light ahead of her. And I thought she was going to say, you know, she had a St. Paul-like conversion. But no, it turned out to be the British Council Reading Room, which had its own generator and was not relying on the main electricity system. And she went in there. She said it was warm, it was light, it was welcoming. And right in front of her was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And she started reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And she said, "This is about Romania," she said. "Here is the wicked witch, Madame Ceausescu, ruling with a rod of iron. Here we are living without Christmas and a constant spied on by the secret police." And she said she bought her copy, she took it home, and she started translating it that evening. However, I have just recently had an invitation to go to the university. I've been to the University of Yash before. Yash, by the way, is spelled I-A-S-I. Don't ask me how you get from I-A-S-I to Yash. I don't speak Romanian. But there have been a series of English language conferences sponsored by the University of Yash. And just this last few weeks, I've had an invitation to go in November of this year to the opening of their C.S. Lewis Study Center there. And Paul Michelson, who goes to Romania probably even more than I do, is also involved with this, so I don't think he can get to it. But if anyone wants details about this conference in Romania, you would be enormously welcome. The conferences are in English, and the Romanians know how to welcome you. It's a great experience going there. They're delighted to have visitors. It's a quite extraordinary experience being welcomed there. I must just mention one talk on the Arab translations of the Narnia stories, which I heard there. I didn't even know there were Arab translations. However, the Arabs do not recognize the Calamines at all. And they are totally, it never occurs to them that the Arabian Nights is one of the major features of the Narnia stories. It's very interesting. It passes right over them. However, I'll stop there anyway. But Yash, November, I think it's November 23rd and 24th of this year.
Crystal Downing?
Well, you've already announced my exciting news, so
yeah.
I'll pass on to others.
Oh, really? That's your personal stuff, but what do you? Okay, I thought maybe it's something in.
Well,
the
I can talk about what is exciting me about my scholarship.
That's good.
If you want. My last book came out with Routledge. It's called Salvation from Cinema. And it is my opportunity to get past Watchful Dragons, because I am talking about how cinema presents religious issues. And so the book is being taught at secular universities, but what I'm arguing, and I had to be very careful about this, because I had to acknowledge religious themes, Buddhist films, Muslim films, Hindu issues, as Christian, Roman Catholic, Jewish films. But ultimately, I am using secular theorists, Jacques Derrida especially, to argue that most religion is predicated upon what Derrida calls an economy of exchange. You do this, you get that. You do this sacrament, you get salvation. You say these words, you are saved. You sacrifice yourself, you get 72 virgins in heaven. And what Jacques Derrida, an acknowledged atheist, says is that anything to distinguish itself from generic religion has to be predicated upon a gift. So I argue in the book, without doing a Christian apologetic, I argue and say, well, this is interesting because Christianity seems to be the only religion in which salvation is offered as a gift. There is not because of works, lest anyone should boast. So I'm able to use secular theorists in order to kind of do guerrilla evangelism. Mm. And that is exciting me.
That's awesome. Do you use Levinas at all in your? I mean, because late Derrida is, I think, influenced by Levinas, and is a much more religious atheist than he was when he was more of an atheist.
I haven't. A lot of other people have, but I haven't.
We're gonna cut this particular part of the discussion now, if I may, because we want to open it to you. So let's have some questions for our panel, please.
First question from the audience had to do with, what are we doing wrong, or what concerns do you have related to Inkling studies?
Oh, I can respond right away. I have a problem with a chronological snobbery that I see among Lewis scholars. So it's ironic that Lewis was indicting chronological snobbery, and yet so many people are writing books on C.S. Lewis without reading what has already been written about him, as though I'm coming up with this, not realizing other scholars have expressed the exact same thing, perhaps more articulately.
Good one. Somebody else? What are we doing wrong? Anybody?
I'll mention something that Donald Williams has pointed out, and that is that it's not that they've gone wrong, it's that they're a little bit hampered by the fact that they can't quote as extensively as they would like to.
Excellent.
And they end up then paraphrasing in bad prose what Lewis says in perfect prose.
Thus creating material for William O'Flaherty to put on his blog about bad quotations.
So thanks to Don for that insight at a conference.
Yeah, and editing the last book from 2016, a few of them I just had to say, you know, you really can't have this many quotations in here. I don't want to get in trouble. And I started just paraphrasing some of them or whatever, or sending them back to the author, because that is an issue. And somebody else, what are we doing wrong? Yeah.
I don't know about this going wrong. It may even be what they're doing right. But I know... the core of my interest is centered on the Books of Seven, the Journal Seven, which I think is a brilliant journal. But I have often been amused by the fact that almost none of the writers embraced by Seven would have liked Wheaton or what Wheaton is doing. And this is just a very interesting phenomenon. Tolkien was a Catholic. Chesterton was a Catholic. Lewis certainly would have had very little truck with what one might call left-wing Christianity, and so on, nor did Dorothy Sayers. And I've sometimes wondered if the people who founded Seven and who founded the Wade Center weren't pulling a fast one on Wheaton by persuading Wheaton to put money into a group of people who would fundamentally have disagreed with them.
Which, that brings up the Lewis as Protestant saint, evangelical saint. Somebody else? Anybody else? Okay, another question.
The second question from the audience was about how can we get young people to read more?
I'll start by saying that one solution to the problem is evident right here in this audience, is that 2 years ago, and for every conference that Devin and I have visited together, probably for the last 5 or 6 years, we've been lamenting the lack of youth at the conferences. And when I showed up here this year, I was overwhelmed by the number of young people in this conference, and I thank you all so much for being here and being so excited. So there are a lot of teachers in here who are doing something right, and we're finally figuring out how, and if you guys can comment on what it is that you're doing to get these young people here, we're finally figuring out how to get young people to read again, and that's absolutely wonderful. As far as one possible answer, I think we should be looking at what we could do in terms of multimedia to attract younger people to books themselves. But some folks have already figured out some things to do. To have as many kids as we have here, I hope that term's not offensive when you're my age, you're all kids. I'm so glad you all are here. Thanks.
One thing, Shirley, a lot of young people are bookish, and they're looking for someone who wants to encourage them in their bookishness.
Can I make a comment on that?
Yes.
I don't know if any of you guys are into BookTube. I am, which is where people sit and talk about books, and most people are like, "You watch YouTube for books?" I watch people buy cantaloupes at Walmart or whatever. That's what's popular right now on YouTube. Supposedly has 2 million hits. But I agree with you, Joe. I think there actually are a lot of bookish young people in our culture, and I mean personally for me, and as an educator, I've noticed this. I'm Gen X, and so I'm the indicted generation that has supposedly fallen away from organized religion, Orthodox Church. I think that honestly, we're starved for spirituality.
Can we quickly there? I think I keep hearing this complaint about people not reading and students not reading. That simply has not been my experience. When I went to Baylor University, they asked me in advance, this would be in 2003, they asked me to give the book list for a course I was supposed to be teaching. And when I sent it in, and I got a note back from the head of department saying, "You have put in 4 or 5 big Victorian novels. You can't expect modern students to read the big Victorian novels." I wrote back and said, "Tough. This is self-selection. Let them come or let them stay away." My course was oversubscribed. The students wanted it. The faculty were trying to calm down the students from reading too much.
I just wanted to say one thing we're doing here is we are gathering together and just gathering together and reading aloud, and people want that, and we've discovered that they actually don't need to watch movies all the time, and they're not necessarily, we don't necessarily have to have a video of the thing. They can sit and in a room with each other, drink tea, and read aloud or read together. And by the way, just a recommendation. What's the one, the Parrot book by Dorothy?
Even the Parrot.
Nobody knows about this book. It's very rare. It is the funniest, wryest, nastiest parody of a children's book that has ever been written. And it's by Dorothy Sayers. And we've had a couple of sessions where all we've done is just read it out loud. And everyone just, thinks it's the greatest thing ever. So anybody else?
Part of the problem is the demise of the humanities on college campuses, at least in America. And a lot of the problem is parents. Those of you who are parents, they are saying, if I'm spending all this money to send you to college, I want you to have a major where you can make a lot of money after you graduate. And so what this is doing is turning education into a meal ticket for the future, rather than the one chance, these 4 short years where you can develop critical thinking, where you can read things that you would never have an opportunity to read elsewhere. So it's, I don't want to indict the students as much as pressure. I get students who tell me, I want to be an English major, my parents will not let me.
One more question.
The third and final question from the audience related to, what recommendations do you have for those who want to be a scholar in English studies, especially for those still in college?
I'll go on this one. One, read as many of his books as you can. If you're going to be a scholar, read all of them and read, and then find the ones that haven't been published yet and read them. Two, go to all the Gracelands around the world involving your particular scholar. Since you mentioned Lewis, then you've got to get to the Wade Center. You've got to get to the Bodleian. You've got to come here and UNC Chapel Hill even. So you know, go to the great places. I think this is more important. Get involved in a community, like showing up to this conference and as many of the conferences as you can. Get involved in the community. Build relationships with the scholars that are already out there because they want to help you. They want to give you ideas for a work that could be done in Lewis or whichever the author that you want to deal with. Because they have been to all those great places and they say, well, you know, here's this manuscript over here that nobody's touched or here's an idea that I had that I'm never going to get to. Maybe you could take this idea up. So developing community, emailing back and forth with those people, that can be a big help towards your own scholarly pursuits. Working in a scholarly community, especially one that's relatively friendly, even when we disagree with each other, is something that a whole lot of English majors aren't going to get in various other subjects.
Somebody else.
I would say as well, start submitting your work to conferences. If you have conference presentations on your CV, that will help you get into grad school. Go after a Lilly grant. Valparaiso University has these grants for any students who would be willing to teach at a Christian college. And you could get scholarships that will pay for your graduate experience. And jobs are fewer and farther between, but it is a smaller pool at a Christian college, obviously, because most Christian colleges want Christian professors.
Anybody else?
Yes, I wanted to say, as the international member of this group, think worldwide. Don't necessarily think of the US or Canada. Most universities have scholarships for overseas students, specially set aside. I've helped one from Texas come to work with me at the University of Kent in England. I remember recommending to a student who came to me in Glasgow who wanted to go and do work on Australian literature, and I said, I know exactly where I can get a scholarship for you. Go to Australia. And she looked at me and said, but I'd have to leave home. And I said, yes. She went away like the young man, very sad. But I only want to reinforce what's being said. Come and talk to all of us, in fact. The way to do it is through personal contacts. Find people you like, find people you want to work with, find people you find sympathetic.
I was going to add to that, if you don't mind, because my first year was, 2012 here, and I was a green, brand new, fresh out of grad school, and I did Lewis in leadership and was told by multiple people that that was a terrible idea. The dean of the School of Education was my initial advisor. He said that was a stupid idea. I can't do it. So I switched advisors and got another one. So, you know, don't give up on your ideas. And I love this community, these people. I made lifelong friends in 2012 here, and I'm just continually thankful for their support and friendship.
And there you have it, the end of the second and final part of the panel discussion from the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium, an event that is presently held every 2 years at Taylor University. Keep listening to this show, for after my closing comments, I'm sharing a small portion of a special session that was held during their colloquium that dealt with an unpublished manuscript from Lewis that was presented by Brenton Dickinson and Dr. David Downing. Also, be sure to listen to the first part of the panel discussion if you haven't already, and look for other podcasts related to highlights from keynote speakers. In fact, if you're listening to this much later than when I first posted it, then you can go ahead and hear them by going to the website and searching for those. You can check the show notes for a direct link to part one panel discussion and for links to Taylor University and past events on Lewis and Friends, as well as a link to the book that came out of the 2016 event featuring a variety of papers presented at the colloquium. You can get those notes at essentialcslewis.com and look for this show. But it might be easiest to locate the notes where you found the audio file, where they are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. I mentioned I'd wait until this ending to give a short biographical sketch of the participants. So here it goes. The panel featured Stephen Prickett, Regius Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Glasgow and President of the George MacDonald Society. Crystal Downing, author of the award-winning book, Writing Performances, The Stages of Dorothy Sayers. And she's also the co-director of the Marion E. Wade Center at Wheaton College. Joe Christopher, publishes regularly about Lewis, including over 20 essays on Lewis's often-neglected poetry, and is on the executive board of the C.S. Lewis and Inkling Society. Crystal Hurd, book review editor of Zanesook, the C.S. Lewis Journal, and she also contributed to the book Women and C.S. Lewis. And finally, Charlie Starr, author of The Fawn's Bookshelf, C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters. And he's also the expert on Lewis's handwriting. In case you didn't know, you can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. If you don't know how to do that, then check the show notes for a direct link and consider rating my podcast there. Finally, let me remind you, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host for All About Jack. In addition to my new book, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis, that explores 75 questionable quotations and also reveals the closest expression Lewis wrote related to the questionable saying, I've also written an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters that is called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Thanks again for listening to All About Jack.
All right, welcome to this session. My name is Brenton Dickinson, and I'm a C.S. Lewis researcher. We have David Downing with us. Of course, a lot of what we're talking about today is about library research. And so basically, this is at this stage, this is a thing that you have to go and see. Where I encountered it was actually not at the Wade, which doesn't have the original copy, but at the Weston Library in Oxford. And so I'm in there, and in this book, it's Letters of C.S. Lewis. It's just a scrapbook from the period. Somebody, and it's not clear who, has pasted a few dozen letters in here, and this includes a lot of the usual suspects who were correspondents of C.S. Lewis at the time. And included in this is actually the Quest of Polaris manuscript in a book called The Letters of C.S. Lewis. And the reason this is because this, I'm going to hand this over to David, and David will give us kind of the story of it, and then I'm going to come back and pull out some things from the text. I can stand there, or you can stand there.
Maybe I could just stand here, and you could.
Yeah, that's good.
We decided to pronounce it Polaris. I've talked to a French scholar. This is probably medieval pronunciation of Blaise, like Blaise Pascal. And some versions of Arthur and
looked at the computer face test.
Oh, okay.
My old age.
There's also a knight Polaris in one of the texts.
Yeah, that's right. So anyway, Polaris is probably medieval for Blaise, and so he calls him, we think, Polaris, 23-year-old man living in the city of Nesses. Ness is a Scottish word for a promontory, or like Lake Ness, and it kind of the setting reminds you somewhat of Belfast. You look across the Belfast Mile at the Blue Hills, the Grey Hills across the way. He courts the favor of a highly sought-after Lady Alice, mainly at his mother's urging, not from poverty of his own heart. He's kind of a young
Don Quixote. He wants to play out the role of the chivalrous knight as he's read about in books, but he's not quite suited for it. When he learns that a marriage with Alice has been arranged, he's not exultant but melancholy. He feels like he hasn't really proven himself worthy of her hand, so he's going to try to figure out what quest would make him worthy of Lady Alice. When he's thinking about this upcoming marriage, he gazes across at the great mountains and experiences joy. Are you going to read that passage at some point where the wind blew through the dungeon of his soul and he felt all this exultance? It may be his first description of joy in his fiction, although at that point he didn't know what it pointed to. This is a fascinating rehearsal or a sketchbook for his later works, because he could describe the experience of joy, but he didn't really know what its spiritual significance was. You have to go to Pilgrim's Regress, even in the Narnia Chronicles, when they first hear Aslan is coming. They all have this numinous experience by the name Aslan. The same thing happens when he hears the name Stryver, who's this mysterious figure. And it's fascinating. At the time he was writing, he could describe the experience, but he didn't know what it meant. He said the same thing about William Morris later on, that Morris could describe it but didn't understand it. And that's where he was as a 17-year-old. Feeling he's a deedless man, unworthy of Alice's hand,